remembrance. Dictionary definition, the act of remembering someone, something, or some past event. Or, the act of remembering and showing respect for someone who has died. Now remembering. As I get older, I find myself getting more forgetful. I don't think dementia's set in quite yet, but nevertheless, I'm certainly getting more forgetful. I'm still not too old to learn, but I find that the more new things that I do learn and that goes into my head, the more it pushes out. And I forget things. So I have a way, or various ways, of trying to remind myself about various things, including making endless lists of things to be done. Or I simply wouldn't get anywhere at all. How do you remember? I suspect we've all got slightly different ways. Do you tie a knot in your tie? Well, I rarely use ties these days, so that wouldn't work for me. Or a scarf, maybe. Do you make lists? Do you use a planner? Or an electronic diary? A whiteboard? Well, I use at home as well. Or do you just simply put things in strategic places so that you cannot possibly forget what to do? Nevertheless, the question still comes back. How do you and how do we remember? So in effect, when you hear the word remembrance, what does that actually mean to you, remembrance? We've just stood for 2 minutes for silence, considering poppies falling from the sky and world wars. Remembrance can have little meaning, especially when considering events that happened many, many years ago. And there's often, like now about the First World War, no tangible memory of them. 100 years ago, the country was just over 2 years into the First World War. A war that would go on for another 2 more years before it ended. 100 years ago, our country's army was almost at the end of a 4.5 month long battle. The Battle of the Somme. The costliest battle in British lives ever. But it's such a long time ago. Why should we remember it? Why should we even try? Is it still relevant now that we're well into the 21st century? Why should we stop and think about the events in that war, and others for that matter, that happened so long ago? Many of us here have never had to live through a war. Or have we? Now we're going to look at the significance of remembrance, especially some of the symbols that have been used over the years, and why it's marked in this country, both on the day of the 11th of November, and also, like today, on Remembrance Sunday each year. Before the First World War started in 1914, wars fought by the British Army and the Navy usually took place in far-off places, thousands of miles away around the world. And the British people generally heard about it weeks or months later, often in the newspaper, proclaiming famous victories. But unless you were related to a soldier or a sailor, the public really weren't affected by it at all. Those that were affected of a loss of a loved one were usually only the family members that were involved. In most campaigns, soldiers and sailors, especially during Victorian times, the numbers involved usually amounted to a few 100,000 people. For example, in the 1853 Crimean War, famous for the charge of the Light Brigade, into the Valley of Death rode the 600. Only 250,000 British troops went to that campaign. Sounds a lot, doesn't it? But when you get into later wars, well, almost goes into insignificance. 250,000 British troops for that campaign. Just over 20,000 men failed to return over a 2 year period. However, in the First World War, 20,000 men could be lost in a few hours. Literally, a few hours. By the end of it, there were very few people in Britain and other countries involved who remained unaffected by it. By the end of it, virtually every family in Britain had either lost a son, a brother, a father, or an uncle who'd been a serving soldier, sailor, or airman. The war reached out and touched almost everyone's life in some way or another. At the outbreak of war in August 1914, we had approximately 236,000 regular soldiers, about 260,000 territorials. We could muster about 500,000 men ready to mobilise and fight. The French, our allies, their army was 3 times the size of ours. Between us, the small Belgian army and the French, we could had about 2 million soldiers. The war will be over by Christmas, it was said. Little did we realise that the German army was almost 4.5 million strong, more than twice the size of our combined allied armies, and we were grossly outnumbered. In effect, by Christmas of 1914, the majority of our original army was either dead, wounded, or captured. It was soon realised that the war could not be over by Christmas, and a massive recruitment campaign was started by Lord Kitchener. "Your country needs you," one of the famous posters of the First World War. Volunteers enlisted in their millions and were sent to fight in places that many had never even heard of before. Gallipoli, Mesopotamia, Egypt, Belgium, France, even Italy. Men were eventually conscripted in 1916, but we didn't have conscription before the war. They were all volunteers. But it was truly a global struggle, a life-changing event for the world forever. Nothing was to ever be the same again. In the opening moves of the war, both in the West and the East, the nature of modern warfare soon became clear. Armies were numbered in the hundreds of thousands, in fact even the millions eventually. New ways of fighting made better and more effective use of huge quantities of shells, trench mortars and ammunition, both in rifles and machine guns. It was an industrial war. Facing such devastating weapons, soldiers went to ground, digging trenches and dugouts that soon began to feel almost permanent. On the eastern and the western fronts, we then had almost 4 years of trench warfare, almost a stalemate. Losses on both sides were tremendous. One of the most infamous battle names that I've mentioned already, the Battle of the Somme. In reality, the British Army was there throughout most of the war, but the Battle of the Somme that we know of started on the 1st of July 1916 and ended on the 18th of November 1916. So in a few days' time, it'll almost be the centenary since that 4.5 month battle ended. By the end of it, over 1 million men were dead on both sides. On the very first day, the worst day for the British Army ever, we lost 60,000 men. 60,000 men, just to try and get it in perspective. Rugeley is about 20 to 22,000 population. Cannock, just over 60,000. So in the space of 6 hours, completely wiped out, gone. Finally, an armistice, an agreement between the countries that were involved in the war to stop fighting was negotiated. And it was agreed at 5 o'clock in the morning on the 11th of November 1918. The armistice was to come into effect 6 hours later at 11 o'clock that morning. The fighting continued right up until that 11 o'clock deadline. In fact, the last British soldier to die died 2 minutes before 11 o'clock. This was after almost 4.5 years of continuous noise of battle, if you can visualise that. Pounding of shells, artillery, machine gun fire, rifle fire, trench mortars. Most of that for 4.5 years. 11 o'clock, it stopped. Completely. The silence must have been deafening for those that were there at the time. By the end of it, over 5 million Allied soldiers, including 600 British service women, had been killed. Now, in order to remember the end of hostilities of World War I, a memorial service was always held on the 11th day of the 11th month each year, from 1919, right up until 1945, during which 2 minute silence was held at 11 o'clock in recognition of the end of the war, the armistice, and the silence in particular that would have been heard on the battlefields the year before. So, hence the 11th hour, the 11th day, the 11th month. That day was known and memorised and remembered as Armistice Day and was always held on that day, whatever day of the week it was. And at 11 o'clock, people around the country would stop doing anything. Just about any job, whatever their role, they stopped for that 2 minute silence and observed it, pardon the expression, religiously. After 1945, things changed. Now that picture you can see there, that's the original commemoration for 1919. It was only made of plaster and wood. There was that much of a public outpouring that the country decided to build a permanent memorial, the cenotaph as we know today. And it's been used ever since. Now, the idea of national remembrance really only began after the end of the First World War, the Great War, the war to end all wars, as it was called. In reality, it led to the Second World War some 20 years later. That war to end all wars was not to be. So when the Great War was surpassed by another war, it became known as the First World War. I'm going to take a look at some of the other symbols of remembrance that have been used since the end of the First World War. As I said, most are familiar with the cenotaph in Whitehall. This is an unveiling ceremony the very first one that was opened in 1920. So it was originally a wood and plaster structure. This is the national outpouring. This is our national symbol of remembrance. Now, most cities and towns and many villages throughout Britain also commissioned their own building of remembrance or memorial, or at least a plaque. But many had simple statues, figures of soldiers from the First World War, which varied in size and complexity, but nevertheless many villages and towns had them. Some in Stafford, Sandon, just down the road, a village has one as well, quite prominent. Then, of course, there are the cemeteries for the soldiers that died, buried wherever possible, near to where they fell. In Belgium and northern France, there were hundreds of British, French and German cemeteries, each with some form of memorial, as well as individual headstones. This one is quite close by. That's on Cannock Chase. Here is one of the many, but this is the largest one, the largest single British war memorial in the world. This is at a place called Thiepval, a high hill on the Somme battlefield that was captured during that Battle of the Somme 100 years ago, near Picardy in northern France. It's actually a metre shorter than the Arc de Triomphe. The French wouldn't have an arc built as high as or higher than their Arc de Triomphe, so this is a metre shorter in height. One thing to consider on it is the inscriptions of 72,000 names of British soldiers that were lost at the Battle of the Somme. Lost, literally, in that they were never found. A significant symbol of remembrance. Now, the battlefields and trench systems of the Western Front stretched over 400 miles from the Belgian coast, through France, right through to Switzerland. The Somme Valley, and eventually onto the Swiss border, and they were constantly under bombardment. Not 24 hours a day, but very few times there would be at least some form of bombardment during the course of each week, for 4.5 years. Villages and vegetation were razed to the ground, and here's an example of some of the conditions they had to live in and fight in. This is actually around a place called Passchendaele. And literally, they had trenches, and they had to get out of them eventually. Once the conflict was over, and the battlefields were abandoned by the troops on all sides, in the next spring of 1919, the poppy was the only thing to grow on what were otherwise barren battlefields that had most of it been farming land at some point. To such an extent that the remnants of the trenches and the shell craters were covered by an absolute mass of red poppies, almost along the whole of the 400-mile front line, all the way from Belgium to Switzerland. Now, the red poppy became a symbol of remembrance ever since. The newly formed British Legion, formed to provide help and welfare to serving and ex-serving servicemen and women and their families, adopted the poppy as a symbol in 1921. They used it for their first appeal to raise funds in November of that year. The paper poppies were all handmade by disabled ex-soldiers of the First War as part of their process of recuperation. It also gave them means of a productive occupation and also provided them with an income for themselves and their families. People see the poppy in a variety of ways. A symbol of a charity that still cares for those who are bereaved or injured in war. A way of remembering the sacrifice made by the many who fought. It can also be seen as a vote for peace. Now, the significance of the poppy as a lasting memorial was realised by a Canadian Army surgeon, Lieutenant Colonel John McCrae, and he wrote a poem in December 1915, in Flanders Fields. And I shall read a short extract of that particular poem. And it says, some of you will be familiar with this. In Flanders Fields, the poppies blow between the crosses, row on row, that mark our place. And in the sky, the larks, still bravely singing, fly, scarce heard amid the guns below. We are the dead. Short days ago we lived, felt dawn, saw sunset glow, loved and were loved, and now we lie in Flanders Fields. John McCrae did not survive the First World War. Remember that I said that by the end of hostilities in the World War I, First World War, the Great War, over 5 million Allied soldiers were killed. What I didn't mention was that there was another 3.5 million soldiers killed on the other side, a total of over 8.5 million soldiers killed in total on both sides. Children grew up in the shadow of war, their fathers absent or lost. Women became directly involved, working in various engineering industries and agriculture. as men then went off to fight, it freed them up to go, including the need to work in sometimes very dangerous conditions, usually in munitions industries, all in order to maintain the supply, endless supply of shells and ammunition and explosives at the front. There were a number of accidental, often fatal explosions. Those are not numbered in the war dead. They were seen as civilians. By 1917, women could also join the army, the Women's Auxiliary Army Corps, and they could serve the country, especially in nursing and the supply and support roles. But the war was not only about military losses. For the first time, we had total warfare, where civilians were deliberately targeted. A new term came to be used, the home front. The first attacks on the civilian population were by naval bombardment, especially on the northeast coast. Believe it or not, that started within the first 2 months of 1914, the war. By October of 1914, our coastal lines had been bombarded. The first aerial blitz of Britain was not in 1940. Bombing began upon our southeast coast with aircraft in December of 1914. By aircraft first, and then by these things, these monstrosities. Airships. There's a photograph of a Zeppelin flying low over Westminster. Imagine what it was like for people on the ground. It's only a few years since that the first aircraft have flown, 1903, 1915. 12 years later, these things are flying over and dropping bombs with ease upon our capital and many other parts of the country. At first, we had no effective answer. They raided eastern Britain, the capital, the Midlands. This area was overflown and bombed by Zeppelins. But believe it or not, they got as far as Liverpool, Glasgow, and even Edinburgh were bombed by these devices. This is the aftermath of a raid that destroyed a school whilst children were actually in it. 18 children were killed. The next photograph is that school remembrance service at the memorial a little time afterwards. There were food shortages inflicted by U-boats and naval blockades and sometimes failed harvests. This weakened the people on the home fronts. Nearly 6 million civilians died from disease or starvation. Another 1 million more were killed as a direct result of military operations. Excuse me, this is by the way on all sides, this isn't just the UK. In all, the estimate of dead resulting from the war, both military and civilian, on all sides, stands at over 16 million people, about half of which were civilians. Then there were the wounded, more than 21 million, blinded, gassed, missing limbs, scarred, maimed. Those at home had to learn to accept and live with their loved ones who were physically and mentally damaged by what they'd been through. Some of the war's effects were not immediately obvious. Mental and emotional trauma caused by shell shock and sustained periods of war at the front were often not recognised or understood to begin with. And when they were, there was a reluctance to acknowledge it as well. Some recovered. Others were never the same again, either in body or in mind. The effects of the war were felt around the world well after the war ended. The old world order was broken politically and economically. The Austro-Hungarian and Turkish empires ceased, and from their ashes many new countries emerged, both in Europe and also in the Middle East. Russia was racked by revolution, became the world's first communist state. Monarchies fell. A new world order emerged, but those changes caused more dissent and unrest and eventually helped to lead to the Second World War some 20 years later. Some of that dissent and unrest is still evident to this day, causing conflict around the world almost a century later. In 1926, after the introduction of the red poppy, the idea was put forward that the black centre of the British Legion's poppy should be imprinted with the words, "No more war." Now this was seen to give it a political stance, and the British Legion declined that. They wanted to stay a strictly non-political organisation. So the Women's Peace Cooperative began producing their own white poppies with the word peace. And they did this in 1933. The Peace Pledge Union helped distribute them in 1934, and white poppy wreaths have been laid ever since 1937. Red and white poppies can occasionally be seen being worn together, but often laid alongside each other on Remembrance Days. Now remember that I said the end of hostilities in World War I, the estimate of dead, both military and civilian, stands over 16 million people. While in the Second World War, the figures were worse, much worse. over 22 million military personnel, but worse still, over 38 million civilians. The overall loss of life during the Second World War was well in excess of 60 million in total, which isn't far short of the population of this country right now. The numbers of losses during those two conflicts were so astronomical, they're too vast to try and imagine it. But one of the biggest single events of loss of life was the use of the first atomic bomb in August of 1945. And then another one was dropped, Hiroshima and Nagasaki, killing over 80,000 people instantly. Twice that figure, further 160,000 died within the first 3 to 4 months after the bombs had been dropped. Here's a photograph of Hiroshima, taken about a month after the bomb was dropped. Note the ruined building featured in the centre of the photograph. It later became part of the Hiroshima Peace Memorial ceremony that's held each year in remembrance of the victims of the atomic bombs. White doves, another worldwide symbol of peace, are released as part of the ceremony each year, where they also pray for lasting world peace. Another memorial or symbol, this is the United Nations Peace, or one of them, the United Nations Peace Statue in New York, formed in 1945. One of their key aims is to try to prevent wars between countries and to continually work to achieve lasting world peace. Now back to our own National War Memorial, the Cenotaph. This may look more familiar to us now, it's in colour too. Cenotaph in London, more recent photograph. As we, as a nation, take time for remembrance, so too do most of the other nations who have been affected by both world wars. For example, one of our key allies, America. Here's a photograph of President Obama laying a wreath on Remembrance Day, 11th of November, and also the Russians too. President Putin, they do the same thing. And of course the French. Incidentally, this photograph shows both President Nicolas Sarkozy and Angela Merkel, the German Chancellor, laying a wreath together at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. That's at Paris at the Arc de Triomphe, doing their Armistice Day remembrance service. The Germans also have their own memorial service. That's one attended by the German government minister in the absence of Chancellor Merkel. They also have many peace remembrance statues. This one is in remembrance of those that died during bombing raids in Hamburg during the Second World War. This next one is nearer to us. This is actually in Northern Ireland and is the Hands Across the Divide peace statue in Londonderry, showing two men reaching out to each other, symbolising reconciliation and finally a hope for peace in the future after the troubles in Northern Ireland. Now the next memorial is almost halfway around the world at San Carlos Bay in the Falkland Islands, remembering those that were lost in the 1982 war. The next one is very remote, on top of Mount Pleasant, but again in the Falklands War. This poignant one, a simple and plain cemetery in Argentina, someone in personal remembrance of the loss of a loved one, also lost during the Falklands War. This unusually elaborate one is actually in Baghdad, in remembrance of the Iraqi war dead in the Gulf War. Next one, another national site of remembrance, which is very close to home, only 12 miles or so away. This is the National Memorial Arboretum at Alrawas. The site has over 250 separate memorials, including civilian and also voluntary organisations of those that were lost. There's even, for the first time, a memorial to cover over 300 British soldiers, First War soldiers that were shot at dawn for desertion, many of whom is believed were suffering from unacknowledged shell shock. So what is the relevance of all this today? I look back at my own life and the lives of my grown-up children and granddaughter, who's here today. I wasn't expecting, but thank you, God. Good to see you. But I thank God that none of us have ever had to take part in a war, or as civilians, to take cover from an air raid, from an enemy trying to hit the civilian population. There are many that say we have the peace and freedom that we have today because of those who gave their all in World War I and World War II. I believe that's true. I look at my youngest son, Ross. He is 18, just, and I thank the Lord that he does not have to put his life on the line to protect our country, as young men of his age typically had to do 100 years ago. And they had no choice. Conscription has started in the beginning of 1916. 100 years ago, you had to go. Nevertheless, there are young men and women who choose to do that still. Right now, each and every day. That peace and freedom earned in World War I, and especially World War II, has been maintained by successive generations since then, still at a terrible cost. Now we're going to see a short DVD of a serving British airman, who is a Christian, thank you Lord. This may give you an insight into how things are, since the end of World War II, how things have been and also still are for our serving men and women. Can we possibly have the DVD, please?
I've been in the Air Force for 7.5, coming up 8 years, and that's of a 16-year commission, so just coming up to halfway. My role, I'm a Chinook pilot. Went through flying training and got selected for helicopters, and at the end of that, got my wings and got posted to the Chinook. Yeah, I spent 6 months learning to fly the Chinook and then been on the front line for about 4.5 years. The environments we work in are dangerous, particularly Afghanistan. You're operating, you know, you're very close to the Taliban, often over their heads. We often do get shot at and come back with a few holes in the aircraft. It's my job to keep people safe. That's my main responsibility and my main role. And I don't really think too much about what happens if. We go through a lot of training with what ifs, if we end up crash landing somewhere and how to escape. But I think I do certainly trust God that he's got my life in his hands. I remember hearing someone saying that we're immortal until God calls us home. And I often think that my life is in God's hands, and you know, and so is my timing. And you know, and that doesn't mean I diminish any responsibility from keeping myself, my crew and my passengers safe. I'll do my utmost. But I think I just have that sort of sense of peace that God's, you know, in my life and is there looking out for me. There was a time in Afghanistan last year, it was in April last year, where I was shot in the foot. That was quite a big challenge. The story was we dropped off some troops first thing in the morning and we were going back in to go and pick them up. So it was during the extract. Landed on to pick up these troops and came under contact from the Taliban. And one of the rounds came through the cockpit. It went underneath the other pilot's legs and ended up hitting me in the left foot. I pulled my foot back. Realised I'd been shot, informed the rest of the crew, and we managed to get away, thankfully, without sustaining any more casualties. On the landing site. But then as we were flying away, I collapsed on the controls, had to get pulled out of the seat, and the rest of the crew did an amazing job of getting us back to Bastion safely. That day, I got to. Straight into theatre, had the round removed from my foot and got sent back to the UK. So I was back in Birmingham the following morning, where they did further surgery to sort of clean and stitch up the wound. But I've just seen God's hand, you know, amazingly throughout that whole sort of experience. I think at the time it could have been so much worse. The round could have hit the other pilot. It could have gone through both of his legs instead of underneath them. It could have hit him in the head, could have hit me in the head. The fact it went through the window and then through two bits of metal before it went into my foot slowed it down enough so that there was no exit wound. And had there been an exit wound, it probably would have removed my foot and taken it off. And I was told the next day that had it gone through my foot completely, they would have to have probably amputated mid-calf and in order to fit the prosthetic underneath. Yeah, I'm just so thankful that, you know, that it wasn't worse. No one else that we were picking up got hit. It was just one round to hit the aircraft and it happened to hit me. And in all the recovery as well, I think I've had such a warm support from friends and family and people looking out for me. I don't feel like I've, you know, the recovery was very quick. I was walking the next day, I was back to work within 6 weeks, and I was back in the cockpit and flying again 7 weeks later. And I just think, you know, I'm pretty much back there 100%, not quite back to running, but, you know, I'll get there eventually. But I'm back to walking, driving, flying, I can do pretty much everything that I could do before. And I've just really seen sort of God's support and hand on my life, protecting me that day. Very much so. It could have been a lot worse. But also since. had so many sort of other stories of God protecting my life.
Thank you. Great. Thank you. So back to our National Memorial Arboretum. The main memorial is in the remembrance of all servicemen and women who died since the end of the Second World War. The names of those lost are inscribed on the inner walls of the memorial. Again, there are statues and symbols of remembrance. There's more than one, but there's an example of them bringing an injured serviceman or woman on stretcher. Here's a list of numerous theatres of war that British servicemen and women have served in since 1945. The list is long, and I don't intend to read them out. You'll probably recognise some, or even all of them, perhaps. The shocking fact is, there's only been one year since 1945 when no British service personnel were killed. Only one year. Each year, more names are added to those already inscribed. Now, I hope that hasn't been too heavy, but this is what it's about. It's Remembrance Day, and I hope that you all now have a better insight into an understanding of remembrance and why we mark Armistice Day on Armistice Day, the 11th of November, and we also remember it on Remembrance Sunday. Now, the Great War feels like distant history. We can see sometimes a jumpy black and white movie film, some fading old photographs, and may even have some among the family members that were there. Some cases, the faces are unfamiliar, in unfamiliar clothes, old-fashioned cars, in some cases, horses pulling carriages. Wagons or carts all look like something from a different world, long forgotten. Yet in reality, the last soldiers who fought in that war have only recently died. But the war has almost slipped beyond living memory. And as the centenary of the end of the war in 1918 approaches, we need to make sure that we don't forget what happened. In order to understand today and to try to avoid repeating history, we need to know, understand and remember what has happened before. Okay, so what does God tell us about this? And what did Jesus say? Now, the verses I'm going to put up, I'm sure you're probably all familiar with, but I shall try to put them in context briefly of war and conflict. In John 13, verse 34, Jesus says, "A new commandment I give to you, that you love one another. Just as I have loved you, you are also to love one another." Now, we're all to love all others, based on Jesus' sacrificial love for all of us. As Jesus is a living example of God's love for us, then so we are to be living examples of Jesus' love for others. In Matthew 5, verse 44, Jesus tells us to love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, so that you may be sons of your Father in heaven. Jesus is showing us it's more important to give justice and mercy than to receive it. By not retaliating, Jesus keeps us from taking the law into our own hands. By loving and praying for our enemies, we can overcome evil with good. In Luke 6, verses 27 to 28, Jesus tells us again to love your enemies, do good to those who hate you, bless those who curse you, pray for those who abuse you. Now, Jesus isn't talking about having necessarily affection for your enemies, but it's actually about an act of will, your choice, a conscious effort, a decision to act in their best interests, praying for them, helping them, giving them the same respect, treatment, and rights that you would want yourself, and also to show mercy and forgiveness. In Luke verse 6, 36, be merciful, even as your Father is merciful. And also in Matthew 6, 14 to 15, if you forgive others their trespasses, your Heavenly Father will also forgive you. But if you do not forgive others their trespasses, neither will your Father forgive your trespasses. A forgiving spirit shows a person has received God's forgiveness and the understanding of the need for forgiveness, in that we're all sinners, and we're all in need of His forgiveness, God's forgiveness. And in Matthew 5:9, the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus also tells us that blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. Now we need to work as sons and daughters of God at being peacemakers. Again, it's a conscious decision. But if we are peacemakers, we are blessed. Something that is appropriate to all, in Isaiah verses 9 to 5, in the first verse, every warrior's boot used in battle and every garment rolled in blood will be destined for burning, will be the fuel for the fire. And then still in Isaiah, verse 5, we are given hope. For to us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government will be on his shoulders. And then, in verse 6, we are told who he is. He will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace, our Prince of Peace, Jesus. Now, it's only right that we remember our armed forces and the price they have paid and they continue to pay in carrying out their duties, ultimately on our behalf. As Christians, though, we should also remember that all of those lost, both military and civilian, on all sides, as a result of any war, for as Christians, we're required by God, as I mentioned earlier, to be peacemakers. We all have a role to play, to work and strive for peace, daily, individually, nationally, and throughout the world, especially in directing our thoughts, prayers, and actions towards the making of peace. Daily. We will remember them. Now, when we prayed before the church started this morning, Jacqueline said something interesting about seeing Jesus on a horse and soldiers following, and she asked the question, who will ride with me? I would say the answer is here. We will follow the Prince of Peace. In Isaiah 2, verse 4, he foretells the triumph of biblical faith, which will bring peace to the world. Peace that the world has never known, when all nations will beat and shape their swords, their weapons of war, into plowshares, farming implements, tools for growth, not destruction. And he says, he shall judge between the nations and shall decide disputes for many peoples. And they shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war any more. Here is the last statue of peace to show you. It is called, and it reflects that verse, let us beat our swords into plowshares. It was a gift, surprisingly, perhaps for some, from the Soviet Union to the United Nations, and it is actually situated in the United Nations Peace Garden in New York. The final symbol of remembrance is this one, a cross. Because as Christians, each Sunday is a remembrance day. It's the day when we remember the sacrifice of Jesus, who won for the entire world a different and deeper kind of peace. Each Sunday is a remembrance day. This morning, we're also going to remember Jesus on this Remembrance Sunday by sharing communion. Can I ask you all to come up and help yourselves to some bread and juice, but take it back to your seats and please don't have it until we can do it all together in one go. So if you'd like to break up into a couple of groups, there's two tables here. Please come up, please come. If anybody can't, or somebody can help those that are less able to, then please do so as well.